Okay, today I'm in Surrey at home with Rishi Prasad. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us today,
Oh,
Rishi.
thank you for coming down.
Now then, I was quite disappointed when I was researching you. There's very little controversy. But,
So boring. That's why.
well, I don't think so. We'll find that out in a minute. But I would like to know how you get on with John McEnroe these days.
We get on fine. There was a brief moment a couple of summers ago when I guess I did look sort of sideways at him. You're obviously referring back to the incident where on the BBC highlights show, Wimbledon Today, they put a clip of one question to Nadal after he'd got beaten at Wimbledon. And unfortunately, the only clip that they used from my entire interview was just the one question where I asked if he was coming back next year. The reason why, because in the press conference prior to that, he was asked about coming back next year and he wasn't certain. Because he's obviously suffered a lot of injuries at the time, health was an issue for him. Anyway, the BBC obviously clipped it up and only because they only limited amount of time, so they clipped up a short section, put that one question, his answer, when he sort of went, "I don't know, I don't know, I'm not sure," and then they cut to Claire with McEnroe and her panel, and McEnroe said, "This guy's who's that idiot that they sent down to do that interview?" So obviously social media, as it does today, picked up on it, and it seemed as if McEnroe was criticizing me, but it was a genuine mistake. Obviously the BBC didn't intend to just put one question in, but time meant that they had to, and McEnroe didn't know that I'd actually asked him three or four questions before I did that. So he and I spoke afterwards, and the air was cleared and we're fine. Although, he is John McEnroe when I'm much further down the scale than he is. And I still look up to him because he was a legend on the court and a fine broadcaster off it.
Now that must be something that is makes your life, you guys presenting, a lot harder these days with the instant criticism that can suddenly come out on social media. Do you actually look at it, or do you just bury your head in the sand a bit?
Well, I'd see it. I don't look for it like I maybe used to when I first started broadcasting. When you first start doing stuff like I did back in 2002, I was so insecure about what I was doing. I was always worried about what other people thought. So as a consequence, I was looking for reassurance as much as criticism, I guess. And the desire to find out what people thought about you was overwhelming. But as the years have gone by, I have become less interested in people criticizing and praising because people do both. And you either get really excited when people say good things and therefore get really depressed when people say bad things, or you try and stay on a nice even keel, which is what I try to do. Occasionally, people say things that might wind you up. And if I have a type of response, I will always read it back. And often I'll probably just delete it and forget it. I very rarely get engaged anymore with anybody who's particularly critical. And if someone says something nice, I just say thank you. Just try and be level-headed about everything, to be honest.
Okay, we can be reel back now from 2019. You were brought up in Trinidad.
Yes, I was born and brought up in Trinidad. I was talking about this the other day. Somebody at work was asking me if I was from India, and obviously I'm not from India, but my ancestors are from India. My great grandfather was an indentured labourer who was taken from India to the Caribbean to work on the cane fields. And then my grandfather sort of took another step up. My father became a lawyer, and he had a huge passion for horse racing and cricket. And he used to take me racing with him all the time, and he ended up owning and breeding racehorses back in the Caribbean. So I found it completely fascinating. I was completely obsessed with it from about 3 years old.
So how big a thing is horse racing in the Caribbean?
Growing up in Trinidad with horse racing, it was all encompassing. It literally was all I thought about when I went to school. My books were my school books, my textbooks, they were doodled with horses all over the place. I mean, I used to get told off at school for not concentrating on work because all I was interested in was horses and the racing aspect of it. They would only race once a week in Trinidad on a Saturday. Occasionally, depending on the season, Christmas time, New Year, they'll race maybe twice that week. And so everything that I did, I sort of geared up for a Saturday racing. You know, even from when I was 5, 6 years old, my dad and I used to record the horse racing. They used to show the highlights on a Sunday, racing Saturday, show the highlights on Sunday. I'd record it, and then through the week, I'd watch it and then ask my dad to come and watch it with me so I could show him something that I'd seen. And then he'd engage with me. And because of that, you know, he and I were quite close growing up because of that interest that we both shared. And so because I had adults who also helped me to develop my passion for it, then it was only going to get bigger and stronger.
And that was Santa Rosa was the park.
So Santa Rosa is now the only race course in Trinidad. But in the old days, when I was growing up, there were three race courses. Right. There was Union Park, which was in San Fernando in Trinidad. There was Santa Rosa, which was Arima, which is quite close to the airport in Trinidad. But the main one was the Queen's Park Savannah, which was in the capital, Port of Spain. And they used to call it the Big Yard. And it was superb. I mean, growing up as a child, it was walking distance from where we lived in Trinidad. And Christmas time, New Year, the crowds were great. We used to be able to go and stand close up to the horses and trainers and jockeys because you have to be 12 years old, or you had to be 12 to get into the stands. You weren't allowed into the stands at that age, so you have to be on the grounds. Occasionally, when my mum wasn't around, my dad used to sneak me into the stands. I used to be in an oversized suit so he'd smuggle me in. But most of the time on the grounds. And obviously, like a lot of other people who grew up in racing and are now obsessed with it, my dad obviously encouraged the odd gamble here and there. And so away we went, you know. I was allowed to have a few dollars bet every now and then. And so, unfortunately, the die was cast at a very early age, Simon.
Did they have race course bookies there?
Yes, you had to. So you either bet with a tote or you wrote a bet down on a slip of paper and handed it to a runner who would take it to the race course bookie, which wasn't exactly legal back in the early 80s. Obviously, I wasn't doing those ones, the written bets. But a lot of people were writing bets down and passing it on. But yeah, race course bookies of a different kind.
Yeah. So were you and your dad successful at beating whatever bookies it was you bet with?
My dad often would occasionally have a big success, but very often he would be annoyed that something went wrong. But he used to get involved in a lot of, because he owned a lot of horses and he used to get involved in a few gambles. It was a lovely horse he had called the Godfather, who was a decent racer. So in Trinidad, they raced from A class all the way down to G, and each category had 1, 2, 3. So A, 1, 2, 3, then B, 1, and all the way down to G3 was the lowest class. And this horse, the Godfather, was basically a D, E class horse. But obviously, as things go, they allowed him to slide down the ratings till he was G3 class. And my dad part owned him with my uncle, who was an airline pilot. And obviously in those days, no mobile phones, etc. So they were plotting for one day that they were going to have it right off on the Godfather. And the trainer kept saying to them that this horse, he could win tomorrow because he's running in the terrible class. He'll win. He's a massive prize. So he said to my dad, "What should we do?" So my dad is actually like, "Well, I can't get hold of my uncle because he's in Canada, and the flight's been cancelled because of snow. He's supposed to be in this hotel, but I can't get hold of him. And anyway, the horse, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do." So the trainer's anyway, the trainer says that, "Well, we're going to run him, and if he wins, great. If he doesn't." Anyway, he won, and he won at something like 76-1 on the local tote. And my dad had a small bet on him. The trainer had a bet on him. But of course, the one person missed out was the other half of the ownership, who was my uncle, who was still stuck in Canada, and then came back to Trinidad to find out that he'd won at 76-1 and didn't have a penny on it. So But he picked up like 1,100 US Trinidadian dollars for his share of the first prize, which was in those days, I think, about 200 quid.
Did they fall out at all about that?
They didn't fall out, but there were some heated words. They never really fell out, but they were heated words.
And it's just interesting that you say there was three race courses, and now there's only one. Why the decline?
Oh, so a few years ago, I said, more than a decade ago, they had the bright idea of doing away with turf racing in Trinidad. And it had only been turf racing. And because it was turf racing, most of the stock that came over from abroad came from the UK. There were the odd American horses to come over, but a lot of horses came over from the UK. And there was a strong British influence in racing in Trinidad. And as a consequence, a lot of people growing up in the Caribbean were obsessed with British racing because the ancestry traced back to there was a relationship between the mother nation, obviously, for a Commonwealth country to Trinidad. And so obviously we were obsessed with British racing and turf racing. And then suddenly they decided that they were going to have dirt racing, and dirt racing became preeminent. Turf racing became a second thought. So they centralized racing for economic reasons as much as anything else, did away with the best racetrack, which was the big yard, Queen's Park Savannah, did away with Union Park, which was also a tremendous race course, and just stuck with Arima and made it primarily dirt racing. And the product declined quite significantly.
Okay, now you pointed out to me earlier before we started this that you didn't actually want to become a jockey, which I read somewhere, but you did want to become a cricketer.
I did. I wanted to bat at number three for the West Indies. I grew up, obviously, in the great times of the West Indies dominating world cricket from the late 70s through to the early 90s. And the idea of walking out of the Queen's Park Oval at number three for the West Indies was what I thought I would. But I soon found out early on that was not going to happen. If the only way I would be walking out would be to carry drinks for someone. Definitely not good enough to play any type of decent cricket. So unfortunately, I never cut the mustard, but I loved it. I loved playing cricket. I loved watching it. I still love it now. I'm still obsessed with the West Indies and kind of basking in the glow of a victory over England in the Caribbean at the Kensington Oval.
Now, it sounds to anybody watching this that Trinidad was a bit of a paradise. So how did you end up gravitating to England?
Again, my parents felt that my schooling in Trinidad was never going to help me in later life. So they thought that sending me to school in England would do that. It's a very Indian thing, which is each generation should progress beyond the previous one, should try and do better, which is, you know, my dad, great-grandfather was a cane cutter. My grandfather did that for a spell, sold insurance and life insurance. And then my dad became a lawyer. So the idea was I was supposed to do better than that. I'm not entirely certain that that has happened. But that was the reason why they sent me to school in the UK. And as a consequence, once I came here at the age of 12, I felt like I came home to where horse racing belongs. So I kind of had that attachment. And racing actually helped, because I went to boarding school as well. And coming from Trinidad to go to boarding school was quite a big thing. But I managed to use horse racing to overcome the challenge of being at boarding school and being scared about being away from home and being scared of big English kids. But racing helped me get through that.
Hey, Rishi, in part one, we talked about your life in Trinidad and you came over with boarding school. So the general public would have heard of you, I'm guessing, is 2002 when you joined out the races.
Yeah, I feel sorry for them, to be honest. I used to work for a PR company and I hadn't taken a holiday for ages. And I went to Trinidad for a month to celebrate Carnival, which I hadn't done for a long, long time. And then I took a couple of weeks off afterwards to recover from that. And when I came back from that holiday, which was February 2002, my boss at the PR company, a guy called Laurie Brennan, he said to me to give this number a call, ask for a guy called Jim Ramsey. and they were screen testing throughout the races. I knew nothing about it. He had written a letter to Andrew Franklin, who was part of the original or High Flyer setting up at the races. And they offered me a screen test, and it was the Friday before Cheltenham 2002. It was the last day of screen testing in Charlotte Street. I went in for the screen test. I had to stand up and deliver a couple of minutes to camera about the day's racing at Sandown. And then they asked me a few questions about racing, a few questions about the Cheltenham Festival, and then I left, not knowing what was happening. And then on the Monday, so 3 days later, they called and offered me a job at the races channel, starting up on May the 1st. So I went into the office and said, look, they've offered the job. And they said, this is what we want for you. Laurie was unbelievable. He's like, you know, he's like a father to me, father figure to me, because he's always looked out for me. And he said, we just want you to do the best that you can for you. And I took the job, went to Cheltenham, back flagship Uber Alles, a rare winner at the Cheltenham Festival, and then backed a whole load of losers. But that was the start of it.
Okay, I don't think I'll be saying anything outrageous if I suggested that horse racing presenting is generally the domain of white, British, certain class people. How did you fit? Were you welcomed? Did you feel you fit in straight away?
Well, I'm going to be honest. No one's ever made me feel unwelcome. Everybody, from the time that I first started, acknowledged. There were a lot of people who acknowledged that I was different, which is obvious. I looked different, and they embraced me. So I didn't feel unwelcome in any respect. There have been times when I have felt that maybe you get a feeling more than anything else. There's nothing more than that. So I have, you know, I don't want to turn this into some sort of something bigger than it actually is. But sometimes you get a feeling of know your place, the way certain people speak to you. But that's very rare. That's very rare. And there have been one or two occasions where I've encountered maybe a little bit of unnecessary awkwardness by things people have said, mostly in social situations, large gatherings where maybe people have had one too many drinks. I remember at the Breeders' Cup in Chicago, a member of the media, I say media, kind of media, he was drunk one night and he was chatting away with an American journalist, and I was obviously only been doing TV for a few months, and he called me over, introduced me to the American journalist, and obviously it was not that far away from the whole 9/11 stuff, so all very sensitive. And the American journalist asked me where my passport was from, whether I was British, how did I get into the country. And the guy, British guy, who's part of the media now, he just sat there laughing his head off. I felt obviously very awkward about the whole thing, and to be honest, I was so shocked. I didn't handle it as well as I could have, because I'd never really had it in my face like that before. But obviously I've never forgotten it. I've let it go, but I remember it vividly. And that would be probably the worst thing that's happened, anything to do with race, since my time on TV.
Yeah, I think the know your place thing is a little bit racing anyway. I mean, just class-wise,
yeah,
it's still that old-fashioned thing that needs to be gotten rid of.
I totally agree. I don't think that's a race thing. I think the know your place thing is just a general way that some people are in racing. And you can understand that, because the history of the sport involves such aristocracy that almost without thinking, it's part of the subconscious. But it's getting better. You know, there are people who are far more open now than they used to be, just in the time that I've been doing it.
Yeah, so none of this has stopped you, obviously, because now you're working with ITV, you've worked with Channel 4, you work with Racing UK, BBC Sport. There's nothing stopped you. So you can tell us and quickly progress through your career.
So I started with At The Races, obviously, May 2002. And then by the end of the year, Channel 4 asked me to do a couple of days for them in January 2003. I think the first day I did at Channel 4 was Haydock in January. The meeting was called off, but I was still there. I did the morning line. Tomo was at another track and I was at Haydock. and then a couple of months doing Channel 4. And I did the Cheltenham Festival for Channel 4 that year. And again, I think that was the year I interviewed Vinnie Keane after he fell off Latta Lomne in the Queen Mother Champion Chase, after he'd pounded the floor because he was so annoyed he was going so well. And then after that, I got offered a job at the BBC, 2003. The first day I did for them was May 2003, and again, it was a Haydock. So I started then, and then I did a few days with the BBC, and the BBC asked me to do some other events, not just racing, which was quite exciting to have a go at other sports. And then, obviously, after the BBC racing team ended in 2012, Channel 4 started and took over all the racing in 2013 and kindly asked me to be part of that, which was tremendous and very lucky, very fortunate. And then, of course, Channel 4 ended in 2016 and ITV have been kind enough to ask me to be part of the team. So somehow I'm clinging on. I don't know how much longer this will go on for, but fingers crossed.
When you say clinging on, you've done the Olympics at Athens, Beijing, London and Rio.
Yes.
So you sort of saw it a bit with the coverage. What would be any special memories from any of the Olympics? I know that's probably a big pick, but...
So many, to be honest. Athens was incredible because the first thing I did in Athens was work with Steve Redgrave on rowing. Obviously, I had to do a lot of prep for it, so I didn't sound like a complete idiot. But being able to work with a sporting legend like Steve Redgrave, who was lovely, that was one of my first memories. Beijing was amazing because I'd never been to China before. And being able to see so many great athletes in a foreign country like that was different because I'd never sort of experienced anywhere that far away from home before. There was great British success at that as well. And then London was probably my favourite of the four so far. I know it's an obvious thing to say, but there was such an amazing feeling of unity with everybody. I remember being in early to do some of the morning shows on BBC Three, and you're watching people walking into the Olympic Stadium, and everybody had a smile on their face. People were nice to each other. Remember when I was on the train going in to work one day at the Olympics, and there was an announcement on the train. Somebody said we'd won a silver medal in an event, and everybody was clapping on the train, which is not something that you often experience, and it was lovely. Most recently, obviously, in Rio, I covered the Great British Women's Hockey Team's first ever gold medal, which was a great memory. And I'd been with them for a couple of days before they went out to Rio, watching them train, chatting to them, getting to know them. So having seen that and then going and seeing their build up to it and then being there for the whole thing was... an incredible experience, and again, so fortunate.
Also, Commonwealth Games. Now, how do they compare to the sort of experience of the Olympics, the atmosphere, etc.?
The Commonwealth Games in Delhi was an interesting experience because there was a lot of concern about poverty in Delhi being shunned and people not really experiencing what Delhi is really like. So that was that was my first time in India, so I enjoyed that experience, and I enjoyed sort of going away from the beaten track on a personal level to experience what that was like. The Glasgow Games were very different because there was obviously far more British perspective for me, and I covered a sport that I know some people kind of turn their noses up at. But I've covered bowls for a very long time for the BBC, and I was able to cover it in Glasgow. And because there's no other event for bowls, no Olympics or anything like that, the Commonwealth Games is their Olympics, and the Commonwealth Games is a very big thing. And I was able to watch some of the people that I know and I've got to become friends with over the years in the sport, having their moment in the sun and sharing it or watching them being successful. And I loved it. So I thought of the two, the Glasgow Games would be one that I won't forget very quickly.
They mentioned bowls to me earlier, and I was very surprised, but in retrospect, I suppose not so much, that the viewing figures for the bows are almost akin to the horse racing.
Yeah. Oh, just recently on the weekend, the World Indoor Championships on Saturday, they peaked at almost the identical figure that the trial day at Cheltenham peaked at, 868,000, something like that. And last year, the Saturday of the bowls got a much higher viewing figure than the racing. It's unbelievable sometimes, the viewing figures on the bowls. You know, a lot of people are surprised by it, but clearly, I mean, it's fair, you pointed it out to me, Simon, you know, there are a lot of bowling clubs in this country, and there's a lot of interest in bowls, and that's backed up by the viewing figures. And it's a sport that people feel comfortable watching, so why not?
Now, I'm guessing that, even though you enjoy the bowls, obviously, the Cricket World Cup was something that you thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh, yeah, I did. I was lucky enough to do the 2007 Cricket World Cup and the 2011 one, which was in India, Bangladesh and Sri Lanka. But the 2007 one was in the West Indies. Unfortunately, home success or chance of a home success was very small, although we did win our first match against Pakistan in Kingston, which I was there for. But it was an amazing experience, although it ended rather sadly for me because one of the final matches I covered was the England West Indies game in Barbados, and it was the match that which Brian Lara announced his retirement at, and I was standing as far away from him as I am from you right now, and he stood there, turned to the crowd at the end of an interview he did for Sky Sports, and he looked at the crowd and he said, "Did I entertain you?" And I was 2 meters away from him. I was going, "Yes, you did!" I was shouting at him because he was my favourite cricketer, and I was sad when he retired. He could have carried on for years. He was that good.
Now we carry on with the sporting events that are always going to go down in history: the Ryder Cup,
Medina, 2012, my first golf event for the BBC. Unbelievable. It's of course called the Miracle of Medina for a reason, but I still, that final day, the noise levels, because if you remember, Bubba Watson was winding everybody up on the tee, asking them to make noise and smacking the ball off the tee with the cacophony of noise at the first tee. And obviously, when the European fight back began, the noise levels throughout the golf course just started coming down and down and down, until, of course, the point when Martin Keimer made the putt to retain, as it was, the Ryder Cup. And the crowd just, obviously, the Europeans in the crowds went crazy. It was just, again, so many times I'm going to use this word, amazing or incredible, but, you know, so lucky to, and I was lucky enough to be greenside when Keimer made that putt. I was also greenside when Woods conceded to Molinari later on.
Right, Rishi, in the previous part, we talked about bowling, the Olympics, cricket, golf. Is it easy, and racing, of course, how easy do you find it to jump from one sport to another and be sort of authoritative on it?
I have gotten better at it, I think. It's not that easy. It wasn't that easy to begin with. I used to fret about not knowing stuff and being exposed for not knowing stuff, because people, as you know, are also judgmental, and they're so quick to criticise, as you said in an earlier segment. So it does involve just concentrating and preparing as best as you can and not exposing yourself by trying to be too clever. And that's the one thing that I hope I'd never try and do on television, by trying to be a smart ass, basically, because you will get found out. And the other thing is that when we do cross sports, it becomes almost easier to make a fool of yourself, because you try to cover up if you feel like you might be a bit short in an area or two. And the lucky thing for being a presenter or a reporter is that really nobody, and this is my big bugbear about TV, nobody should really care about us. Nobody watching TV should really care that much about who's the reporter, who the presenter is, or even the commentator. What they should care about is the action that they're seeing, the people that they're watching, the athletes, whether it be horses or humans. That's what we care about. And when people get so wound up about who's presenting and which TV channel is presenting, which TV presenter is doing, which reporter is doing it, I often say to them, honestly, and I've had this conversation with, you know, from the likes of Claire and Lucky, and, you know, I said to them, really, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. I've never not watched the sport that I care about or watched the sport that I care about because of who's presenting, reporting or commentating on it. I care about the sport, so why should I be that bothered? I may not be that interested to hear what they have to say if I don't like them or I don't care for them, and I may be interested in wanting to hear what they say if I do like them and I do care about them, but it's not going to stop me watching the sport. So I find it very difficult when certain people in the media make it about them. I think that's wrong, and I really would like people to stop wanting to be in the spotlight as much as they do.
Okay, the one sport you do know about is horse racing, and adding to your what must be vast air miles collection, the Breeders' Cup you've done.
Yeah, I did the Breeders' Cup for the first time in 2002 at Arlington, which was Rock of Gibraltar getting beaten in the mile, which was painful. But great racing again, and luckily enough went back the following year to Santa Anita and watched the Dead Heat, the Johar High Chaparral Dead Heat, Islington winning, Kieran Fallon, great ride. And that was a great experience. And then the following year, I couldn't do the Breeders' Cup. And I couldn't do the Breeders' Cup in 2003 because I was doing highlights of the Breeders' Cup for the BBC. And Lucky was the one who took over from me. And of course, Lucky is Lucky, isn't he? He's a great presenter. I was never going to see that role ever again.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. But you've been covering racing in Dubai for 12 years.
Yes, no, more than that. Started the 2004 was my first Dubai World Cup presenting. And then I had obviously a couple of years that I missed for the cricket. But since then, it's been doing the carnival, and I love the racing out there. I know some people, again, they turn their noses at it because they find it hard to comprehend some of the ways things are done out there, the fact that, you know, Godolphin dominate, etc. Perhaps that's not always appealing to racing fans, but there are certain aspects of the Dubai World Cup Carnival that are really exciting. The fact that you got, you know, Scandinavia, Koreans, Australians, it's a great place to get to know people and to meet people that you think so far away, but, you know, Chris Waller's over for the carnival. He's got horses racing this year. You know, the trainer of Winx, we can chat to him on television about stuff like that. And it's a great experience. So why not embrace it? You know, what's the harm?
No, I've never been lucky enough to have been there, but and there's no betting at all. So how does the atmosphere on course compare to Cheltenham Festival, for example? Do you get the excitement?
The locals, they can't obviously bet, as you say, but they can take part in competitions on the race course, including like pick six. There's trifectas for every race. You know there are pools which the Dubai Racing Club put up, so you can win. It's actually very hard, but there is some form of competitions. But yeah, it's not quite the same as Cheltenham Festival. I'm entirely honest, the Cheltenham Festival, you're comparing it with something.
It's not a fair comparison.
It's on a different level. Yeah. You know, Cheltenham Festival is probably as good an atmosphere as you'll get at a race course. But World Cup night, an absolutely fabulous place to experience racing under the floodlights. Huge crowd, huge stand. You know, it's the one night that huge stand at Maidan is in real full effect. Everybody is desperate for a spot there. The crowds are huge. The racing is top class, and the locals really respond to local success. And of course, the local success has been commonplace in recent years. So it's a night that's, again, had a fantastic atmosphere. And when they get a great horse coming over from America, whether it be California Chrome or Arrogate a couple of years ago, they love it. They appreciate it. It's just like, you know, how people talk about Ascot compares with Cheltenham, and how Cheltenham is on another level to Ascot because Cheltenham people really get in behind the racing. They love the racing. And it's a similar sort of, that's the one thing that you would compare. So the people love the horses. They love the racing. They really appreciate the athletes and the jockeys.
Randy, you mentioned Cheltenham. Now, not many presenters would have presented at Cheltenham and ridden at the festival.
You say ride, you say ridden.
The St Patrick's Day Derby.
Ridden is a loose term because I didn't quite ride properly. My saddle slipped in the St Patrick's Derby in 2014, I think it was. Not my proudest moment. But listen, I it was for charity. I did all the exercise. I did the jockey's test. I had to pass the test. And I helped raise some money for cancer research, which was the main reason for doing it. And I got an amazing buzz out of doing it. And I know that I nearly fell off, but stayed on, thankfully. Somebody was watching out for me. Everybody said before the race that when you stop, when you pull up, you're going to be knackered, your legs are going to be like jelly, you won't be able to walk. When I stopped and I got off the horse, the only thing I wanted to do again was to go round. I wanted to get back on the horse and do the whole thing again. I felt unfulfilled at the end of it.
So anybody watching this now then, you're still up for it?
I'll be up for doing that one again. I feel there's unfinished business with the St Patrick's Derby at Cheltenham, and I'd do that one again. I'm not sure that I'm that keen to do it for any others.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot now. People are going to be envious of all the things you've done and covered. Forsake all of them for just one. Which one would it be?
As you can imagine, people ask that question quite often. And if I really had to choose one, racing, cricket, I absolutely, obviously adore the sports. I love horse racing, I love horses, I love cricket. But if you talk about a sports fan going to an event, which is how I'm going to determine the criteria for choosing something, it would have to be the US Masters. I'm a sports fan, being very lucky and very privileged to be doing the job I'm doing. So when I go to these events and I'm doing the things that I'm doing, a lot of the times I might look like I'm in control, but inside I'm just like any other sports fan getting the opportunity to be up close and personal with heroes. And the idea of, because I love golf and I play golf, the idea of being at the Masters, which is hallowed turf, being in the locker room with interviewing the likes of Tiger and Rory and Dustin Johnson and Jordan Spieth and everybody else. The number of times that I'm in that position, I've been doing it since 2013, and the number of times I just say to myself, do you know how lucky you are? Do you know how lucky you are to be doing what you're doing? There are literally hundreds of thousands of fans who would love to be doing that. And it's the one event where I think to myself, I don't want to give this up. I don't want to give up the Masters. I love it so much, particularly because the players treat the place with such reverence. The history that goes back to, you know, the 30s with the Masters. And you just think about all the great moments in Masters history that you've watched on a Sunday evening, you know, as a kid growing up, and you hear that music, the BBC titles for the golf programme. So many memories. And the idea of now being, you know, part of it, it's something that I really treasure. And I look forward to it every single year.
Okay, so we got the dream stuff. Now let's get back to some gritty racing politics. Two things, the whip and Kempton Park. Quickly tell me your opinions on those two hot potatoes.
The whip, I'm like a lot of people. I think a lot of people have made the argument that perception and reality are two things that need to be separated. And I am very much of the opinion that the reality is the whip is not something that hurts or abuses horses. So we have to be very careful that we don't allow perception to determine how we govern the sport. So I think friends of mine like Dave Yates, James Willoughby have made coaching cases for the fact that the whip is something that does not hurt a racehorse. Therefore, why should we acquiesce to people who have no particular interest in our sport and change our rules just to suit what other people who don't care about the sport may think. So I'm very much in the same camp as they are. As for Kempton, there is a part of me that says, in the grand scheme of the world that we live in, you know, what's more important, housing or race course? That there is a part of me that thinks like that. But obviously, I'm also a racing fan. And I'm also somebody who acknowledges the history and tradition of racing. And the overwhelming part of me, the overriding feeling, is that I would hate to lose that. And I would hate for somewhere like Kempton. You know, I'm sure you've, like me, Simon, you've been to Kempton on Boxing Day. You've been to Kempton. Even I remember going to Kempton at the Easter meeting when they used to have, you know, the turf racing at Easter time. Love that meeting. Good crowds. Great racing, and I'd hate that to disappear. Just like, you know, like as a kid growing up, I got so obsessed with racing in Trinidad at Queen's Park Savannah and Union Park, and then they closed those down, and with it went all those memories. So I would hate that to just be memories, and I would like Kempton to hold its position.
Okay, on a personal level, you've got a wonderful life traveling the world. You've also got a young family. Mm. So how does that sit?
Sometimes it's difficult. I'm lucky enough to have an understanding family, although my daughter's sometimes she gives me a little bit of jit about being away from home. But the job is what it is, and it's about finding a balance. And there'll be times where I won't be at home that much. The travelling does get you down, does wear you down physically as much as emotionally and mentally. But, you know, gosh, there are far worse things in the world to be doing than what I'm doing. So I try not to complain because, you know, gosh, you know, think of other people doing jobs for less reward and they don't complain. So why should I? So I always think to myself, try and balance it out. Do what you're doing. Try and make an effort when you're around. Don't waste the days, and hopefully make people happy.
And finally, Rashid, you've done a lot of things. Is there anything left on the list?
Good one. Good question. I've got to be honest, because I've never been the type of person who's really gone out to chase things. I've not, you know, it was never my, because thankfully my boss wrote a letter off, as I said, all those years ago, asking for my screen test, and one of the, if I was a batsman, the way I would use the analogy is I prefer to let the ball come to me rather than go charging down the wicket. So in that regard, I'd rather not have any expectations of what the future may hold, and hope that things continue going okay, and that maybe there might be some other twists and turns of interest along the way.
Brilliant, Rishi Prasad. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Son.
Download the Star Sports app from the App Store or Google Play. All of the Star Sports markets, including in-play, all easily accessible from your phone or tablet. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.